I see quite a big audience, right? I see from as many people, I see things here. This talk will be, at least on the ADS-CFT side, quite untechnical. There is stuff in there, it's sort of standard. And it's really much more related to sort of the central challenge in this whole business that we're supposed to bring together string theory, holography, and condensed matter physics. And the rules of the game in condensed matter physics are you have to please these experimentalists. You have to tell them what they're supposed to do, and when you don't tell them what they're supposed to do, nothing will happen. And for this thing will happen, you know, it will have not much impact in the condensed matter community at large. Okay. Let's say I'm a bit senior in the meantime. I'm sitting in these advisory boards of big meetings. And I've been campaigning to get real string theory, giving plenary talks in the big meetings. But it has been very unsuccessful, not because these theoretical condensed matter physicists were obstructing it so much. There's a lot of sympathy, a lot of interest for it in principle. Also a bit of scare, perhaps. It's hard work to learn holography, that's it. But experimentalists dominate the committees, and as long as you know, these theorists dream up all kind of stuff that has no consequence for the lab, nothing will happen. Now, the story I have is one where we believe that we can really kick the ass of the experimentalist. We have applied for an experiment that can be done, and that we think is a critical test whether that highlight of holography and condensed matter physics, the holographic superconductivity, is at work or not. And there's some success. I have already a little group of experimentalists that are thinking about it, and hopefully in the next year or something, they will start to write their funding proposals, and perhaps in 2, 3, 4 years from now, the outcomes of the test will be available. And as I said, we believe it's a critical test, so you can really prove or disprove whether sort of the basics of holography is at work in our matter systems or not. Now, in order to, I mean, part of this is the kind of show I give at condensed matter meetings, where there are lots of experimentalists, and I have sort of a marketing slide in the beginning, and I want to show it to you. Hopefully you find it funny. This is about a proposal to build a condensed matter incarnation of the James Webb Space Telescope. Every string series knows what the James Webb Space Telescope is. It's successor of the Hubble Space Telescope, extremely expensive machine. And NASA threatens to run out of money because of it. So the condensed matter incarnation of this with the purpose to, is this working? Yeah. Either embarrassing series or win Nobel Prize just together with string series for high TC superconductivity, conductivity, and so forth. It's a joke, of course. Now, the experiments we suggest is quite dissimilar to the James Webb telescope because it's cheaper by about a factor of a million. And it's a simple junction, a Gaussian junction type experiment. And to keep the tension up, I will explain at the very end how it works. All you really have to know is that there is this experiment by which you can directly measure the imaginary part of the bare susceptibility. And the claim is when you know that information, you learn a lot about the mechanism of superconductivity, enough perhaps to prove or disprove holographic superconductivity, right or wrong. Now, perhaps you're also trying to make the case that condensed matter physicists and string theorists can be very good friends, have a lot of fun together. I think something is working light, and I have myself a lot of fun with it. And this is basically the crew we have right now. And of course, that includes Stringy folks. Everybody here knows Kunrad, I guess. Andre is sitting in the audience. These are youngsters, there are now 2 more graduate students. And on the condensed matter side, at least with regard to this particular story, most of the work was carried out by this PhD student. He was sort of the leader of the effort. And a postdoc who did very hard work. and two real experimentalists. Gemayda, she's a senior happy fermion person, more or less retired, he was very helpful. Also Hans Hilgenkamp, who is an ace experimentalist with sort of nanotechnology things. He was not directly involved. The people who are on the paper are the ones in red print. Again, look it up, it's just accepted for physiology, hopefully it reads well. So the target is really these famous quantum critical strange metal bad metal systems we find, like in cuprates, like in fermions, and perhaps also in particular superconductors. And there's this thing that when you have this bad metal, somehow automatically superconductivity pops up with a tendency to have a very high TC. Right? That is this whole problem in condensed matter. And I guess Max already talked about it at length 2 weeks ago in another talk, so I don't have to go into this. Another idea is, this is not for the string series, but for the condensed matter folks. Back in 1997, there was this major breakthrough in string theory by Maldacena, demonstrating that there is this very deep duality between gravitational physics in this so-called bulk and one higher dimension and field theoretical physics in the boundary, where sort of the crucial thing is that the field theory has to do with conformal field theory, CFT, and that's just the mathematical way of saying that somehow you're dealing with quantum systems that are scale invariant on the quantum level, that are quantum critical. And at some point we started to realize that we were talking about the same thing here, and then this pursuit broke loose. Now the highlight, or not the highlight perhaps, but at least the thing that is most settled in the condensed matter context coming out of holography, is this beautiful idea of a holographic superconductor. You can encode a superconducting instability in terms of the physics of a black hole that fills a scalar field. At some point, that scalar field forms a horizon, an atmosphere around the horizon, and that translates into superconductivity in the field theory. Which is very well settled now. I think we understand it's best of all, perhaps. And the question is whether this holographic superconductivity has any bearing on this high TC superconductivity and so forth we see in our mysterious condensed matter systems. So this is the introduction, and let me now go into the body of the talk, and this is the plan. First, I want to tell you a story about how useful the knowledge about the dynamical susceptibility is when you want to understand the origin of instabilities. And this is very well developed when it's about magnetism, so I'm going to tell you a short story about how this has worked in the past. And magnetism was for me the inspirational source to dream up this bare susceptibility ploy. Then I will focus in on the bare susceptibility and how it works in the conventional BCS and also this Hertzsprung-Chubikov contact Max was talking about last week. Then I will show you how that works in holographic superconductivity. Then I have a short detour in a very simple toy model, which is very close to holographic superconductivity, to sort of fit in the steady system behind it. And finally, hopefully as a climax, this recipe to build this pairing telescope. Okay. So the central claim of this whole story is, when you want to learn about the origin of superconductivity in the laboratory, you get the maximal information by measuring the dynamical pair susceptibility, and I guess everybody reads what this is, so this is the pair operator, and you just look at its propagator. And you want to measure this in the normal state. You want to see how the pairing instability is building up in the normal state. And there's really no more information you can get about the origin of the instability than by looking at this animal. But to illustrate this, let me tell you an old story. This goes back to the mid-90s, and it has much to do with this realization that high TC superconductors have dealings with quantum criticality. And that's about looking at the magnetic fluctuations in cuprate superconductors. So there you look at the magnetic equivalent of the pair susceptibility. So here you have the spin operator. Look at the spin-spin propagator. And this is very accessible by inelastic neutron scattering. Inelastic neutron scattering measures this pretty directly. is of course a very, very big business. And in the mid-90s, it was especially Kate Apley, also the driver of all of this, went out to see whether he could kind of nail down the quantum critical behavior of these spin fluctuation and coup rates using his neutral scattering machinery. Where the idea is basically like, here is a phase diagram of the coup rate, so here you have the antifair magnet, here you have the superconductivity. But these are a different axis that we can give a good name, it's basically strain in the lattice. Having the fact that when you're a bit away from the crystalline superconductors, you might run here into an instability. And this instability is the static stripe formation. And stripes are these things where you have both charge density waves and you have antiferromagnetism, which is peculiar workings that when you have these waves of charge, when you pass them, they're also a domain wall in the antiferromagnet. And that's the fact that the ordering wave factors shift away from the usual pi-pi point, meaning a simple staggered magnet, to these longer wavelengths because you have this extra periodicity. So you find incommensurate spin fluctuation sitting at these incommensurate wave factors. So what you then can do with neutral scattering is you just tune your machine to these wave factors and you go to finite energy. It's very important. There's no static magnetism. It's about superconducting systems. Yeah, there's no static order. And when you get above some energy, you start to see fluctuating remnants of that stripe antiferromagnetism. They look like this in the real data. And now you can measure up these peaks. You can look at the width. You can look at how the intensity varies as a function of temperature. And they figured out that they do actually very pretty scaling behavior. Most striking scaling behavior you find in the width of the piece, kappa, that has sort of a temperature energy independent piece. There is disorder, static disorder. And then there's this piece that is proportional to the geometric average of temperature and energy divided by an energy scale. And when you believe in quantum critical scaling, there should be here a 1 over z. Now they took the data, they find a scaling collapse assuming that z is 1. And this shows you that its width is actually a scaling function of the ratio of energy over temperature, which is this hallmark of real conformality, strongly coupled quantum criticality at work. Pick up more information like you can also look at the amplitude, and it turns out it gives you information about the correlation function exponent, eta. And you find it to be very, very close to zero, which is actually consistent with the 2 plus 1 dimensional Heisenberg or O3 quantum nonlinear sigma model universality class. Now, the story continues that when you cool this stuff down, it starts to superconduct. And then you find out that there's an absolute gap in the spin fluctuation spectrum, which is like the superconductivity gap. Right, then you conclude that you're a bit away from that quantum phase transition, and you're dealing here with a spin system in essence with dynamical mass generation. This is just to illustrate right, what kind of information you can get out of that dynamical susceptibility when you're dealing with quantum critical systems. Let me now turn to the pairing context. So again, the claim is we would like to play the same game as we just did with magnetism, but now is the pair propagator. And this information is right now not available. We don't know how this pair propagator is working, right? So it can be in principle measured. I will explain much later how that has to be done. So there's no experimental information, but we can now build up a theoretical expectation based on several, you know, prejudices regarding the basic physics of the superconductivity in these systems. Let's start out with the most conventional way of understanding superconductivity is, of course, BCS. All condensed matter physicists know this very well. I learned that string theory is not always knowing. So this is something we teach in condensed matter physics 101. And it's called the RPA. BCS is part of this. It's just the zero frequency limit of IPS. IPS basically time-dependent mean field, and mean field is your pair field. Now the way it works is, everybody knows that, you, in order to hunt down the VHS instability, you have to do the bubble sum, right? So you have to hear the fermion bubble, and here you have the effective-effective interaction. You resum it, and you ask now the propagated question, and it just acquires this form, where chi naught is the pair susceptibility associated with the Fermi gas, just the bare bubble. And there you have this denominator, 1 minus g, the chi of the Fermi gas. Now, in order to find the subconducting instability, you need to have a pole in this expression. In other words, the denominator, the real part of it, has to go to zero, where you take the bare susceptibility to be at zero frequency. In the Fermi gas, the imaginary part of the bare susceptibility is 1 over F, order density of 6, same thing. And at the final temperature, you multiply this with the 10H of energy divided by temperature. So actually, the bare bubble is conformal, right? It's doing an energy temperature scaling, but this is an artifact of the recoupling limit, as you will see later. So you do the Kármán-Kronig transformation of this, you want to know the real part at zero frequency, because this animal at zero temperature is constant. You pick up here the log, you plug in the log in this expression, and you find the famous gap expression of BCS theory, which tells you the gap is exponentially slower than coming. Right? Now what you actually do is something much better. And that's full-blown Eliasberg theory. The Eliasberg theory is that you assume some everything except that you ignore all further corrections. And you have there a good excuse, which is called a Mikdal parameter. And the Mikdal parameter is the ratio of the glue frequency, the boson frequency, divided by EF. So there can be a small parameter, although everything else is very strongly coupled. And then this is supposed to be in the limit of Mikdal parameter opposed to zero, still a pretty exact treatment. The hard part is really here to get it on the real frequency axis. So there's a lot of technology available to solve the equations in Max Baryon frequency or imaginary time. But we want to know it in real time and must overpass the Tudor force to actually compute the pair susceptibility of Eliasberg in its full glory on the real frequency axis. So it's not quite standard, but this is really the only hard technical work in the paper of ours. So let's now see how that works in practice. So let's first start out with a popular hypothesis, and it's called superglue. Right, so that is sort of the fulcrum condensed matter physics. People want to see BCS, but when you do that with phonons, DC will be low. So you need to have a booped up phonon that might well be a spin fluctuation at high frequency. You have a stronger coupling. But you continue to assume that you have a nice isolated propagating boson doing the hard pairing work, right? So that means that the so-called glue function telling you how the attachment action works is just set by this single boson frequency. I put this in Eliasberg, and actually this is in a rather weakly coupled still, and you compute the imaginary part of the pair susceptibility. I absorb this part, it tells you where the excitations are, and you can make a nice false color plot as function of energy. Notice this is on a large energy scale, this is 100 times TC, and it's a function of reduced temperature. So this is temperature above the transition in a normal state. So here you are at a very high temperature, and here you have a very big signal that you get when you approach the transition. Now this is actually very well known in the subconductivity literature. How does it work? First go to high temperature, you completely forget that there's a pairing tendency, and you just get to see the susceptibility of that Fermi gas that I already explained. Now when you now approach the transition, the denominator in RPA starts to play up, and you get a peak that is initially quite broad when you're some distance away from the transition, and away from zero frequency, and you approach transition, that peak sharpens up, and comes down, and right at the transition you get a delta function peak at zero frequency, and that signals the transition. You can as well understand this in terms of just the relaxational dynamics of your order parameter that is still too condensed. So you write down an overdamped Ginzburg-Landau, right? So there's a single time derivative because the pair amplitude is not conserved in a normal state. That's relaxational dynamics. And from that follows this kind of universal linear response form for relaxational dynamics. You know all these numbers, right? And you can quantitatively address in the BCS superconductor how this relaxational behavior develops. Okay, so this is pretty boring. Let's make it more interesting. We had a beautiful talk last week by Max Smolitsky, who explained this other mainstream view on the origin of quantum critical superconductivity in condensed matter community, where you say, I just have this picture of a quantum phase transition where we have a Fermi gas or a Fermi liquid that's just sitting there, but then there's some bosonic order parameter, like an antifer magnet, that undergoes here a quantum phase transition, and then the quantum critical fluctuations of that order parameter shaping that kernel system. Now, that has a first consequence that the electrons are around and they will damp these order parameter fluctuations, and it will have the generic effect that the dynamical physical exponent of the bosonic sector goes up. But the electrons are in principle dangerous, and when you do you see, we must explain that that pair channel gets very, very active. It seems that the singularities associated with quantum phase transition are sort of swallowed up by the pair channel. These quantum critical fluctuations just turns into effective bosons that will cause pairing. And you can treat it in several ways. And Max explained that. He discussed it in a renormalization group language. And he also explained that you can do as well just Eliasberg CUE up to all orders exactly, what Overpass actually managed to do. The specialty is that now your glue function is very interesting because it's algebraic. And because this thing sort of diverges zero frequency, you get an effectively enormously strongly coupled problem. There's also here a real sense of retardation, right? So the most dangerous fluctuations are at the lowest frequencies, and that gives you a sense of control. And the theory, you know, could in principle work. It's a reasonable theory. So this was worked out in detail by Andrei Chubukov, and you can just look up their papers of how it exactly works. You can compute it, what Overpass did. And you find now for the pair sensibility this plot. And this looks now a bit more interesting than the BCS case. You go to low frequency and you find again that relaxational peak reason is you have a mean field thermal transition, and therefore you have to have that relaxational peak. And it will behave closely in the same way regardless of what you have. So that's not interesting. It's much more interesting to go to high frequency, and you have no longer that sort of flat BCS Fermi gas thing here, but now you have here a pretty interesting peak, right? So the normal state gets kind of shaken hard by these critical order parameter fluctuations, and you know, when you would measure this peak, then it would already tell us a very interesting story that indeed it might well be that superconductivity is caused by these quantum critical fluctuations. Okay, this is a template. This is what condensed matter physicists want to believe. And let's now turn to holography. I don't want to really explain much about holography. That's a talk by its own for the condensed matter physicists, so just take it for granted and see how it works. I just skip this. Just for the condensed matter physicists, a very short overview of where the successes of this holographic approach in the condensed matter context have been up to now. It started out with addressing what's best called hydrodynamics, so your expressions at time scales very, very large compared to the inverse of temperature, to these quantum critical systems, and you get kind of very beautiful universal behaviors. It's on the condensed matter side mostly Subotsuchev, who has been energizing this case. And it only falls down the fact that when you have this complicated slash conformal state, that you find the universal relaxation time. So the time associated with production of entropy acquires a kind of a universal attitude. Where I find it very fascinating that this relaxation time is now set by h bar. So there's this relaxation time, which is of order h bar divided by kVt. So h bar is dimension of action, energy times seconds. kVt is the dimension of energy. So this is a time scale. And you find out that when you're dealing with a complicated system at finite temperature, ask higher number of questions. In fact, the dissipation scale is set by h bar, and I coined this Planckian dissipation as a nice name for it. So my only contribution to this is figuring out that interesting scale sign. Now, this is behind the business of the famous minimal viscosity result that you directly find out of holography. Where you find out that you expect a kind of universal behavior of the ratio of viscosity to entropy density, which is like 104 pi put back the units, h bar divided by kb. Again, you find here that h bar setting the property of viscosity, which is about dissipation. This was seen in the quark gluon plasma. It's now a bit of a booming business in the unitary fermion called atomic gases. Very interesting work. Now, when I learned about this, it was ringing all kinds of bells, because the notion that this time scale is at work in at least Cooper superconductors has been around since the early 90s. I learned this from Subhasachdev at an Aspen Wind conference in 1991. This is a bit perhaps true, but I like to think that for several reasons it's good. So let's first think how the viscosity entropy density ratio, how that can be of order of h bar divided by kb. You sit down and you find out that the ratio of viscosity to entropy density, just using hydrodynamics, is equal to temperature times relaxation time. And if relaxation time is h bar divided by kvt, this viscosity entropy density ratio has to be of order h bar divided by kb. Right? So you see it directly at work. The 104 pi, for that you need holography. Now let's go to the context of electrical transport in a normal state of cuprates. To nail down what the transport relaxation time is, that's in principle something else than the relaxation time you have in a viscosity normal hydrodynamics, but let's be just very crude and just think about scales. What you're supposed to do is measure the optical conductivity, because then you can disentangle the different time scales at work. And this was done very carefully by my dear friend Dirk van der Meijl. I was sort of myself involved doing kindergarten scaling considerations. And Dirk nailed down that in his hydrodynamic regime, where temperature is less than frequency, you find a Drude-like transport, which is actually unreasonable. We still don't understand it. However, there is a characteristic time, inelastic scattering time, better be called transport relaxation time, that is A times H bar divided by kBt, where A is 0.7. Right, so this transport relaxation is again governed by Planck's constant. That I always found a big signal telling us that that normal state of cuprates has dealings with quantum criticality. Then it's simple, because you want to know what the DC resistivity is doing, that is a proportion to 1 over the transport relaxation time. That goes like h bar divided by kVt. Henceforth, the resistivity goes like kVt. And that's what you see in experiment, the famous linear resistivity. Right, so there's this direct link between Hollard Planckian dissipation and this mysterious linear resistivity in a normal state of cuprates. OK, it's a little diversion. Let's get back to the mainstream of holography in the last few years. So an important development has been to start to ask questions about how the fermionic responses look like in holography.
Question for the slide. Yeah. There's different lifetimes. There's transport lifetimes. You're
lumping them all together. Yeah. It's just a scaling argument, right? The scale is set by H bar.
Many systems don't.
Yeah. It's deeper than that, right? So when you just use elementary scaling considerations, you expect that the conductivity in a tubeless one-dimensional system, conductivity system, should be independent of temperature. And it just follows from the fact that the electric charge is not renormalizing. And you only pick up engineering dimensions, a famous argument. Now, in the same paper, it's explained that when you go to high frequency, you find that the optical conductivity is a branch cut, 1 over I omega to the power 0.3, I think I remember. So that can be, and it's hard to explain where this, that 0.3 is coming from. However, in that case, you don't expect a Drude response, a simple relaxation response at low frequencies. Right, so you're completely right. We don't understand what's really behind this. And all I really have is the fact that that transport relaxation time is set by H bar. But it can only be when somehow conformally invariant shift is at work. But so this is still a very mysterious.
Is that like a Fermi surface, sort of scale, and then just coming
in? Yeah. When you do your honest to God Fermi liquid type theory, I mean, there's this famous thing that you look up your metal physics textbook and you find that the tau Fermi liquid is H bar divided by kVT multiplied by EF divided by kVT. Right, so EF is a scale out here, and it's this vast discrepancy of scales. EF over, divided by kVT is supposed to be a very large number, like 10,000, right? And this transport relaxation time is just extremely short in Coupe rates. And nothing else than that the slope of the linear strip is extremely steep. And it's really unsurpassed. And it seems to be also the case in heavy thermal superconductors and pnictites and the linear elasticity. Right, so it's a very crude scale argument for claiming that I understand it. Perhaps, you know, you understand it. This is constructed by Hong Liu, with these thermal loops in ADS. That could be.
But this is a result of ADS or a result
No, this is just pure deep phenomenology, right? It's just doing very good scale arguments. It's just measurements, observations. Right, so this is pure data, this is measured in the lab, and it just turns out that you can neatly collapse it with a Drude form, relaxational form, and from that you isolate a time scale, and then the other argument is saying that time scale can only be when somehow that quantum system underneath has no intrinsic scales, otherwise the time scale cannot be.
So the experiments give you
signal 1? This you measure experimentally, that's easier.
And then you fit that to a Drude.
It's really a staining collapse. It's kind of a smart way of doing it, right? So you just measure the sigma 1, the optical conductivity, and then you say, right, that you, when you assume it's a Drude, you can plot H bar divided by kVT sigma 1, as a constant times 1 plus a squared, what is it, h bar omega kVT squared when you believe the relaxation time, and then you have here h bar omega divided by kVT versus this quantity, and you see that everything collapses. It's like an energy temperature scaling in a very primitive form. And from that you conclude that there's Drude with that scale, time scale a times h bar divided by kVT or a is 0.7. That's just pure empiricism. No theory, and as Joe emphasized, completely correct. We don't understand theoretically. Okay. So you still sort kind of open thing in holography to figure out how you can avoid the scale.
You say that is a consequence of
duality? No. It's saying that somehow conformal invariance, quantum criticality is at work in that bad metal in a way that we still don't quite understand. Holography is coming.
But you said that at higher frequencies this crosses over to some power law, which is not 1 over omega. So is it understood how the...
No. This is...
Is the coefficient of this omega to minus 2/3, is it temperature dependent
It behaves in this way as you expect, right? As energy is large compared to temperature, things turn temperature independent, as it should.
I see, but then it's not clear how the two...
Absolutely not. That's an official push for anybody who can solve this. They'll contribute significantly to the understanding of Couperet. Yeah, so now I turn back to holography. I just picked this motif of holography of the hydrodynamics, right? So somehow it worked in some very gross sense also in the couperates. So let's now turn to the modern developments where we started to worry about what happens when you push a system to a finite density and look at the fermionic responses. And this produced very interesting surprises. Basically, okay, we in Leiden, especially also the MIT group, pointed this out. You find there, when you have the so-called Weissel-Nordstrom black holes and ADS2 metals, you find obviously fermionic systems. They have something like a Fermi surface, but a priori there are no real quasi particles out there. And it sort of looks like what we know empirically from the couperates, which is called marginal thermoliquids. I go very quick here because these are sidelines for the main line of the story. So let's now get to this holographic superconductivity idea, where deep inside issue is you have this ADS4 space on the Dirac side. There's a black hole sitting in the middle. You want to go to finite density. The black hole gets a charge. It's a charged black hole, right? So not some black hole. And that has a very interesting new horizon geometry, an ADS2 geometry. And the new horizon geometry tells you about the deep infrared physics on the field theory side. There's an emergent criticality that's now purely temporal. It's very interesting. It really looks like things we see in the lab. But there's also a very interesting problem of principle, and that is that holography is also telling you that this kind of metal state is kind of infinitely unstable at zero temperature, because this black hole has a strange trait that when its hot temperature goes to zero, there's still a finite horizon area left. And the dictionary is telling you that means that the field theory has a ground state with finite entropy, and it's of course very, very bad. The thing cannot exist. It has to do something to get out of it. Again, this was resonating in my head. It's something I've been carrying out for a very long time. This is like from 10 or 15 years ago. And so I was arguing like, why is DC high? And then the standard answer is because there is supergluon binding electrons in pairs already at a high temperature. And I dare to say this is wrong, guys. You asked the wrong question. Because we know that the superfluid density in high TC superconductors is tiny. Now, what is a superfluid density? It's more or less the same thing as an elastic modulus of a solid. Now, when the elastic moduli of a solid are very, very tiny, you have a very floppy crystal. It's like a colloid crystal, something that barely hangs together. So a diamond is very large. And that usually goes hand in hand with the simple fact that you have a very bad cohesive energy associated with the formation of the solid. In other words, the free energy of the superconductor is actually pretty bad. Now, to have a transition from another state, a metal state is competing with the superconductor at a high temperature, you need to have that metal has a free energy that's even much worse. Right? So the height of TC is originating in the instability of that competing metal. I've used this argument many, many times. People were saying, like, yeah, perhaps you're right, but, and then they fall quiet. So I liked this instability of the ADS2 bad metal. And deep inside, I mean, I understand that holographic superconductivity basically as where you have that metal state is guided by the Weissel-Nordstrom black hole.
Why does instability
doesn't necessarily mean no free energy? It is the free energy of the normal state and the superconducting state cross at TC. Right, when the free energy of the superconducting state is already very high, the normal state gets much more entropy than the superconducting state, right? But somehow that free energy, at least at low temperature of the metal, has to lie way above that of the superconductor. That's a general argument. Okay, so I like to understand holographic superconductivity really in this language of, you know, the metal state itself is extremely unstable, and somehow it has to get out of it, and therefore it wants to become a superconductor or a fermi liquid, whatever. But the big driver is the instability of that normal state. Now, the beauty is, this is in a very natural way encoded on the gravitational side. Well, first pointed out by Steve Kupster, and then so-called H-tube made it all work. And the bottom line is that you have that Reichenhausen black hole, you have to add scalar fields to the CUE in the bulk, and then these scalar fields get subjected to a super radiance instability, which really means they get sucked into the black hole and they form effectively an atmosphere surrounding that black hole. You pull it through the dictionary and you find out that a VAF, a superfluid, order parameter sets in. Now this was all acting out in a very sane way. So this is the way that the scalar hair is distributed in the ADS. You call here is the boundary, here's the horizon, and you see that sort of picks up as a horizon. You look at the thermal history of the order parameter in the field CU, and it's doing a pretty boring mean field job. And there were also these sort of more neat sides of this oligarchic superconductor. This I like that most. And this is just pictures of the fermion spectral function, the photo emission you compute by sending in probe fermions to this hairy black hole. So you compute the fermion spectral functions inside the oligarchic superconductor. And you find out that there's a neat Bezier's gap. You have these very neat, very sharp Bogoliubov fast particles. So it really looks like what you all the time see in real life in photo emission experiments on superconductors, except then that when you start to heat this up, you find out that these very neat Bogoliubov fast particles of the superconductor start to broaden out very rapidly. And they are about TC, everything completely overdamped, because you were back in that normal state, non-fermi liquid, ADS2 metal. These things you also see all the time in real-life photo emission experiments in cuprates, at least in the anodized regime. You only have these sharp plasma particles when there is superconductivity. And somehow, when I show these pictures at condensed matter meetings, it sort of appeals to the audience. That is the patient we see all the time, and it's actually not very well understood in any other way. It's the only way I can understand what we seem to see in the data. Okay. Now then, so it continues. The oligarchic superconductivity has now quite a history within the oligarchic community. There are these various top-down constructions, which is sort of telling, yeah, it really happens in the field series we know. And perhaps the most important message you saw from Johanna and of Steve Kupster is that that VAF is eventually related to fermion pairs. Right? So there's this problem that in these field series described by top-down holography, you have that whole zoo of bosons and fermions and so forth. You don't know a priori it's condensing, but there's quite a bit of evidence that what's really condensing is fermion pairs. C dagger in the condensed matter language. Okay, so this is a very short overview of what holography has brought us in this particular context. And let me now turn back to the main theme of this talk, which is what does this all mean for the pair sensitivity? So to compute the pair sensitivity from holography is really very easy. It's like an afternoon work. We actually used a rather recent generalized formulation due to people here. We just call it double trace deformation. Now, the way it works for the condensed matter physicist, you have the gravitational space-time, the bulk, and there you just let loose a classical field theory that includes Einstein gravity in an end of the sitter space, so you have here the curvature radius of that space sitting. Then you add Maxwell fields, and then in order to get the oligarchic superconductor, you just add here a scalar matter field that's just doing a Higgs job in this context. And in this particular implementation, there's also this the tonic term here that I'm specialist is very important. Now you, want, you can then look for solutions, and you can include these solutions where you have atmosphere at the horizon form out of side fields. And then you have to translate this to the field theory, and you have that remarkable device called the dictionary, and the dictionary is telling you, go near the boundary from ADS, where it ends, as far away from the black hole as you can be, and then you study how these fields fall off, and there are arguments that they always have to fall off in particular algebraic ways, and now these coefficients, and then you find out that in this case, the pressure stability in the conformal field theory is set by the ratio of these coefficients. And that is magic, but that's the way it works. So that is the original H-cubed holographic superconductor, and then there's this more modern extension of it that is saying, I can now add terms to the field theory that are relevant information, so when I switch them all on, they will eventually overtake everything. And they are in the form of double trace, so you have you pair operators, say, or you say the field of the CFT that we call O, and then the relevant information like kappa trace O squared. Then by magic, as long as you are in that normal state, as long as you don't have that condensate, then you have to worry about back reaction, but in normal state you don't, you find out that the influence of this double trace deformation is completely absorbed by a modified dictionary rule that is saying that the pressure stability changes due to the pressure of what amounts to basically interaction term between these formulas when you believe that it's all about pairs by adding 1 minus kappa psi minus psi plus in the denominator. So what you see is chi naught 1 minus kappa chi naught. That chi naught is now the bare holographic superconductor that is now by double trace. I don't know, I was talking yesterday with Gary about it. Gary didn't realize that this is exactly that RPA form that we all the time use in condensed matter physics. So it now works like this bare holographic, minimal holographic superconductor gives you a bare stability. And now you can kick it around in an RPA way by adding interactions that can be either repulsive or attractive. And again, it's sort of emphasizing how close in a way a holographic superconductor is to a BCS superconductor. It's still very different, right? Because this guy not out here is rather unrelated to a free Fermi gas. But it shares this sort of Cooper instability trait deep inside, like a generalized Cooper instability. Does that work? Okay, so we use this, and it's kind of nice because you can kick around things. They're more flexible when you have this double trace on board. And we consider two particular limiting situations, just for the purpose of illustration. One of them is where the charge out here, there should be a charge area, is very large, and no double trace deformation. And there you find that the holographic TC is of order mu, so this is like a local pair superconductor. At the moment you find that there's a finite density, you start to form pairs and they condense immediately. The other limit is we take that very, very small, we tune up the double trace deformation, which is like a very, very strong repulsive interaction, sort of pushing down the original instability. And now you get into a regime, and I can just indicate it in this picture, where in the first case, right, you directly start to form pairs when you feel that there's a finite density, like local pairs, and then you tune down TC until you first get into this ADS2 metal regime, where you finally undergoes a superconducting transition. And this is what we like to believe could have dealings is real-life superconductors. I understand that Hong Yu gave here a talk in the first week, sort of much more systematically mapping out the games you can play with the double trace, where you can both suppress TC by going to playing right with the mass, the scaling dimension, the field theory, as well as with this double trace deformation, And a very interesting story, and it just reminds you why that there's much more to play around with in your setup. So we just take two limiting representative examples. So we compute the imaginary part of the persistent stability, you get the same colorful plots, right? So again, energy, temperature, and the colors indicate the magnitude of the imaginary part of the persistent stability. Now for the ADS4 and for the ADS2 case, you compare that. This is what I showed you earlier, some of the BCS, especially critical glue, and now you can ask the question, where is the difference? So the experimentalists can measure it, and they now have to say whether it corresponds with these type of holographic superconductors or this main simple mass matter BCS superconductor. There's a difference. The difference I can explain very quickly to the string series, but perhaps to give everybody on board and also to advertise a bit more way of thinking very simply about these matters. Let's get now into the complicated BCS story. This is a scaling toy model I figured out together with Wang Che, actually before holographic superconductivity was discovered. And it's completely phenomenological and has very little pretense. It's just sort of saying, can we think in very simple ways about the origin of superconductivity, which is yet different from the BCS way but closely related to it. So we depart from the notion here that there's still glue. In this regard, it's like BCS. So we can still use that RPA expression, and perhaps you want to use very boring standard glue in the form of a powerful boson. But now we just make the ansatz, if you pull out of our head, there's no reason to use for this bare persistent stability the one of the Fermi gas. We observe it in the decoupling limit, the Fermi gas gives you a conformal propagator out here. And we just said, okay, why not generalize that and sort of go away from that marginal scaling dimension? So BCS is marginal. So we can now just assume that perhaps it can have even a relevant scaling dimension. So in BCS, the Guiding-Dollard point would be flat, and it's irrelevant, and it goes down, and that is likely not very good for superconductivity. Let's assume that it can also be relevant, and it picks up. Now you can go to finite temperature, and then when it's a conformal propagator, it needs to have this scaling form. That means basically that at very low frequencies, it first has to rise up linearly, imaginary part, and then at very high frequencies, there's no about temperature, and at a frequency of order temperature sort of bends over. And you can sort of borrow scaling forms out of, say, two-dimensional conformal field theory to model this, and that's what we did. We also include retardation. There's some gymnastics can be done, not very hard. And now we can sort of address the issue of what does this mean for superconductivity. And now you get a very simple model. So we have to solve basically this equation, so here's the real part of the persistent stability. For BCS, alpha is 0, sorry, alpha is 1, that produces the log, that produces this exponential form for the gap equation. But let's now assume that we have a relevant critical case. You just plug in everything, you do the integrals and you evaluate it. And you get now, instead of this exponential depends on the coupling constant gap equation, you get this algebraic equation. And you already feel that there's a good news. It's especially interesting, and perhaps a suggestion for those who want to further explore holographic superconductivity. Retardation has now a very interesting role. It's kind of unexpected. You have to solve the equations to find this out. And so summarized in this plot, so here we vary the coupling constant. Here we have the gap expressed in terms of the boson frequency. And these lines are, we vary the retardation scale. So we start out in BCS, so the gap would behave like this, like the dashed line in BCS. And now we loop up the retardation, so we make the boson frequency smaller and smaller compared to the cutoff frequency, which is like EF. And you already see that for a rather small coupling, this complicated BCS gap shoots up when the degradation scale becomes smaller and smaller. So in no time, you have a gap that's of order of the Bose frequency. And now you can do scary things. I was generically hated for this slide in the mathematical community. Let's believe that the glue is done by phonons. And everybody says, oh, that cannot be. Sure, it cannot be in BCS, but let's not do this complicated BCS. So we use there some reasonable scaling dimension, not very important actually what you take, as long as it's not marginal, quite insensitive. So the phonon frequency in cooperage is 50 millielectronvolt. A reasonable cutoff scale is 500 millielectronvolt. Everybody will start to applaud. The typical gap in cooperage is 40 MeV. When you do this for the normal BCS case, you need a lambda larger than 1, as Bolli says it can be. But using the critical case, you get away with a lambda as 0.3, which is the generic number for the electron-phonon coupling strength in cuprate. So when the cuprate metal would be of this complicated kind, then phonons can cause high TC. It's a real-life complication. Perhaps this might be going on actually in real-life high TC superconductors. When you do string theory, you can see this is like a relevant relevant double trace deformation. And now this is a bit of a diversion, perhaps I skip this because I'm running out of time. I'm nearly there actually. And let's now get to the bottom line. So I've told you the story about complicated BCS, and I announced that this will teach you something about what to do with the data in order to get a sharp contrast between all these standard BCS-like scenarios in condensed matter and holographic scenario. Right, so these pictures, where's the difference? We also now have to call the critical BCS picture, which grew quite like these pictures when you stare at it. What is the difference? In case of critical BCS and these two holographic cases, we know that when we go away from the instability out here, you're supposed to have a conformal pair propagator coming out of that truly conformal normal state. When we approach the transition, we start to feel that conformality is broken because we know that there's an instability at the finite scale, right? And it explains the stuff here. So let's see what happens when we now do an energy temperature scaling. So when you have a conformal propagator, there should be a scaling collapse. When you plot it as function of energy divided by temperature, you multiply it by temperature to the power delta, where delta is scaling dimension, and then it's like finite scaling dimension such that things collapse. The outcome is seen here in the lower panel, which boils down to, you find out that after rescaling, this pair susceptibility becomes completely temperature independent. It's wired in by hand in complicated BCS, and it is basically tuned to be the case in this and this holographic case. Now you go to standard BCS, and okay, it has still a conformal attitude. When you start to switch on couplings, you go away from the recoupling limit, starts to deteriorate, and that gets really interesting when you go to this critical glue, this Chubikov case. You find that in no way you get a scaling collapse. So the normal state pair susceptibility of this Hertz-Miller's type of physics cannot possibly have energy temperature scaling in a normal state. So here is the key to finding out whether condensed matter scenarios work or either the holographic scenarios work.
So why is this not being done for
ADS? Scaling is extremely powerful.
The holographic gun, maybe a smoking gun for scaling.
I would say, I mean, the way I define holographic superconductivity is like you start out in a normal state made out of fermions. It's strange. We don't quite know how to think about it in a normal randomization group. And it's really conformal. I think about this ADS2 state in reality. That's the interesting one. There is no such thing as a real Fermi surface or a Fermi energy. That is all not in accordance with conformality. We know that the collective responses, to which also the pair susceptibility belongs, also magnetic response should be of the kind, should submit to this conformal invariance. That conformal invariance is directly visible in the data by submitting to the scaling collapse. Scaling collapses are very powerful weaponries in also dealing with classical critical states. And then out of this conformal normal state, automatically that superconductivity pops up. There's no sense of a Fermi surface and the big step that is possible for the Cooper instability, so it cannot be the BCS mechanism. When you then go to these other cases, you find out that you always feel that Fermi energy. When you think it's Fermi liquid with sort of perturbations around it, okay, you can then demonstrate, it was also Max talked, when you go in the very, 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 very deep infrared, by shaking the Fermi gas from below with quantum critical fluctuations, you can again get an emergent conformal invariance. But that thing is living very, very deep in the infrared, and at temperatures larger than we see, the first thing that happens is really that pair instability, I referred to what Max was saying, and you just get it out of your Gossberg when you compute it. Before you can reach this emergent conformal regime coming out of these Hertzsprung type scenarios, the bearing intervenes, and the temperature is higher than that, you are in a kind of a messy, perturbative crossover regime. And that still knows about the Fermi energy coming from the Fermi gas, and that destroys the scaling. And I think these are very, very general statements about how these things work. In a deep sense, this condensed matter Hertzsprung pairing is still resting on a Cooper mechanism, and that you lose completely in a lock of it. So in that sense, I think it makes sharp statements. We've got kind of questions like you can now think differently, and let's try something like imagine that your normal state is a marginal Fermi liquid. Okay, Hong Liu would say I can argue that when you look at the single fermion propagators. Now we can just dress up the fermion loops with marginal self-energies. We can now hit this with all kinds of clues using Gossberg. Do we get scaling collapse? Do we get conformal pair operators? The question is no way. So this example is computed here, both for a normal glue and for this quantum critical glue. And you try to do a scaling collapse, and no way that things are collapsed. Right? So it's again a next sign of holography at work. You look at your single Fermi response, and it's like it's 1 over omega minus VFK minus sigma, where sigma is some interesting power law frequency. Then when you think perturbatively, you think BCS, you would say, oh, I just take that propagator, compute the Fermi loop out of it, use that as a bare stability. That will never give rise to a conformal pair propagator. Right? So it's this discrepancy between looking at collective response and seeing real power loss in the conformal behavior. And in the temperature setting, on the one hand, looking at a single Fermi response, you see something that is superficially more like a perturbative thing, is also again a sign of this holography. And we don't know, right? You have to measure this pair stability in order to see what's going on. Okay. So I just said this. That is sort of a final issue. God knows there might be other ways that you get at this kind of relevant pair propagator. Completely detached from holography, I don't know. I like to think that you can think about quantum theory as just a poor man's way of addressing the scaling behavior of pair propagators coming out of holography. Yes, I'm basically done on sort of my final slide, and then I have to tell some slide experiment. So there's really not a big difference. Holography gives you much more of an explanation of why you have this scaling. And I skip this. So in order to figure out what's going on, you have to ask experimentalists. And perhaps it's even more than this. I have been wondering 25 years of my life about the origin of the mechanism of ITC superconductivity. And still we don't know. And part of the reason is that experimentalists didn't have the right information. So doing this experiment will be great anyhow, and perhaps you know, it's a good excuse for the experimentalist. It thinks he can be embarrassed to start working on it. All these experiments, it goes back again to a person who has had a long career here at the UCSB, Duke Scalapino. Original idea was due to Farrell, and Doug made it into a neat formalism. And the idea is actually very simple. What you're supposed to do is you just make a Josephson junction. So you have two pieces of superconducting metal with an insulating barrier in between. But now you take care that one superconductor has a very high TC, and you don't want to know anything about that high TC superconductor. Just pay attention because it's a bit confusing. On the other side of the barrier, you have a superconductor that you find interesting, that you want to find, that you want to interrogate, and it has to have a much lower TC than the superconductor on this side. And then you do your experiments in the regime where the strong superconductor is still superconducting, and this superconductor is in its metallic state above TC. Then the statement is that actually the current that flows through the junction is directly proportional to the imaginary part of the barrier stability, and you have a bias on your junction equal to E times V, and then you measure the barrier stability at that energy. And directly you measure it at zero momentum, but that's good because superconductivity lives at zero momentum, so that's where the instability is playing out. How can this be? It is just a linear response to it, a very natural one. So in the strong superconductor, you have this pair field. This pair field leaks out in a weak superconductor, like a linear response perturbing field. And then you know to get the imaginary part of the response function, you always have to do Fermi's golden rule, second order perturbation theory. And it's now like you're back and forth with a Josephson coupling hop, right? And that is just translating into the fact that the current is proportional to the imaginary part of the barrier stability.
Think about this as Andreev tunneling.
Not quite. I would think this is really a Josephson tunneling.
But it's not. It's not a superconductor on the other side.
No. No.
So how's it?
Somehow it's vital that you think that, like, we get this linear response idea working, right? That this barrier field really leaks out in the weak superconductor, infinitesimally perturbing it. We can discuss it. I mean, there's literature, and there's indeed to compute it. I think there was mention of Andreev scattering, but I'm not quite sure how it plays out. Okay, now the story continues. This came up when I think Dirk was still in graduate school, and he was friends there with Alan Goldman. And Alan Goldman is sort of master of tunneling in condensed matter physics. And Alan started out his career as his professor, actually implemented this experiment. He knew it from Doug, and he did it in an aluminum lab junction, where he measured the barrier stability of aluminum, and he managed to pick up that relaxational peak associated with the BCS phase transition. Here it is in aluminum, and you know it's glorious because it behaves exactly the way it should do in a recoupling BCS superconductor. So it was demonstration principle, yes, this works.
Sorry, what is that, an AV current? Or what
this is
that?
Yeah, this is the current versus the bias. This sort of classic, I mean, many people are aware of this result. Now the story continues. Why didn't this go into a big booming business in the experimental world? Alan told me the story, it's really silly. So in order to do these experiments in the early 1970s, you needed a computer for subtraction. And back then, Alan was the only guy having a computer in his lab. So nobody else could do this experiment. But then people started to get computers elsewhere, like in 1976 or something. And it was time to do follow-up work and try other superconductors. But then Koslis Taulis entered the scene, and all tunneling people started to study Koslis Taulis. And then this was forgotten. There was only one follow-up experiment recently in 2008 by a French group looking at a 60K superconductor perturbed by a 90K couplet superconductor. I don't think it's very interesting what they called out, but they demonstrated that they had a signal, sort of demonstrating that even at temperatures as large as 70K, this can work. An issue with normal quasi particle current contributions, but I don't want to have to use that. Last slide. So, what is the suggestion of experiment? You want to have a quantum critical metal that goes superconducting at a low TC. You might think it's bad. No, it's very good because in these heavy thermal systems there are lots and lots of these very interesting bad metals. So our preferred heavy thermal system serum iridium indium 5 is quantum critical at ambient conditions. You don't have to apply fields or pressure. There's a TC of 0.4 Kelvin. Now you need a strong superconductor, and that is not a big deal on my screen. Yep. It has to have high TC. It has to allow for tunneling in likely a D-wave superconducting channel out here. But there are lots of ways of getting there. You can use a cuprate. You might even think about a conventional S-wave superconductor like the magnesium diboride, taking care that you have a tunneling contact. These things can be done. There's only one problem out there, and it's to make a good insulating barrier. And Laura Green, who is sort of owning tunneling in heavy thermals, has been working already 50 years or so to get good insulating barriers. It's just very hairy from the point of view of materials. My experimental friends are all saying, oh, it's just a matter of throwing money at it and graduate students and be patient, and somehow it can be done. Right now there are like three groups who are seriously considering to take up this experiment, and I hope that something will happen in the near future. That's what I wanted to tell you. I have here the main arguments on the field graph. And sorry for being taking too much time.
Can you just repeat why the double trace accommodation was better in suggesting experiment? I mean, you said on the ABS side.
Yeah, so I'm basically, I mean, the kind of link is that this is sort of a suggestion to do some easy follow-up work on the double trace. And basically nothing else then. You can think about this quantum critical BCS as an example of the way that the double trace works in the case that the system in the absence of the double trace deformation would have a TC equal to zero, and then you take an attractive double trace so that TC goes up. The suggestion is really that retardation is playing out a very interesting role. So in principle you can imagine that you somehow incorporate a frequency dependent kappa. I don't know whether that can be done. I believe it can be done. Like just to study the other interesting effects of retardation in this context.
Yeah, so in the holographic superconductor, is the ABS2 one, where, I mean, if you turn off superconductivity or look at temperatures above the superconducting state, does it look like you have an extensive entropy?
Yeah.
That sounds kind of pathological.
Now, you have to be careful. Yeah, you have to be careful. And there was even this little burp a little while ago, and Sean and me were both involved. It was like, shouldn't it be the case that when it's holographic superconductivity, that you see the workings of the zero temperature entropy somehow in your thermodynamics? And Andy McKenzie went out and said, no, it's not there. But life is not so simple. I mean, it's basically like, it's only when you are at zero temperature that you really have that zero temperature entropy. When you raise temperature, and let's say you go to that ADS4 case where TC is quite high, that whole extremal horizon hasn't formed yet. Right? So at these temperatures, that normal state is thermodynamically, from the point of view of how the entropy develops, quite low, as this especially you can see. Right? So the zero temperature entropy, it's not quite the case that because there is zero temperature entropy, you have holographic superconductivity. It's more like, yeah, that metal is very unstable, not in that absolute sense of zero temperature entropy, already at the temperature where the transition, superconducting transition happens.
TC is much below EF, and you look at the entropy, this much of temperature, does it look like it's extrapolating towards a constant as you go towards your own temperature? I mean, if it does, that's
My good feeling, I mean, it still has to be very carefully checked, actually. of my string theory friends to do some explicit calculations is that in these realistic cases, right, sort of what we show here, it will be really impossible to dig out that zero temperature entropy data from the real thermodynamic data because the temperature where the transition happens is still so high that you don't quite feel that there is eventually zero temperature entropy. These entropy balances, right, that promise that you can dig out perhaps zero temperature entropy only work in a BCS unit.
Yeah, maybe you're sort of conflating two things. I mean, these plots with the scaling form of the Cooper pair, that doesn't depend on this entropy.
Yeah.
I mean, there are other versions where you don't have entropy and the superconductivity will still happen and these plots will look very similar.
But if you don't have the entropy, it's a normal state, not from a liquid body?
Yes.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
You don't have a finite Z. So this is the entropy when Z is into it. So the
entropy goes like T to the 2 of the Z. So when Z is infinite, it goes to the constant. Right, so the two statements. One statement is, in the particular AdS2 setting, isonosome setting, you have exactly at zero temperature, the zero temperature entropy, which is like a monument of instability. To say that the holographic superconductivity is just caused by it is a strong overstatement. What is true is that somehow these non-thermal liquids are quite unstable states. Right? And it's sort of in the gravitational language that you want to have that scalar hair developing is telling you that. You can play other games. I mean, it's still in the production. We know ways and light to tune the bad metal, the AdS2 metal, to a thermal liquid. And sort of vary that thermal liquid scale where it sets in, and then you see that the holographic superconducting transition temperature goes down. Right? Because you have now that much more stable thermal liquid state, and superconducting has to fight it. That's sort of the way it works. Mark?
Somewhat different question. Can you go back to one of your first slides, which had the bearing susceptibility of a thermal liquid?
Right. Well, very beginning, right?
Yeah,
very beginning. Yeah. In there. This one.
So, in which way does that not have omega over T scaling?
It has in the recoupling limit. Right, so thanks for the question. It's in a way very remarkable.
I mean, once you go to omega much larger than gap, then the denominator doesn't matter
exactly
anymore.
So it was the motivation for the quantum-critical BCS, right? So you observe that the bare fermion loop is a pair propagator that is conformal and it just is marginal, right? So the scaling exponent is zero. So we had the idea, why not put here then an interesting scaling dimension? Right. Now, the issue is that when you do Eliosberg, you start to dress this up with perturbative corrections. At the moment that these perturbative corrections become noticeable, the scaling form completely collapses. And that's what we compute, right? So, yeah, I can step forward all the way. So, let's say this Chubakov case is, you have extremely strong perturbative corrections. And manifestly, the energy temperature scan is completely wrecked. Right? The same thing, you just take, say, the marginal thermal liquid self energy, you put it in your loop, and your pair susceptibility is no longer conformal. Right? So the interesting part is that in the recoupling limit, you get an effective conformal invariance in the pure Fermi gas.
So you're saying once I have gamma, then I lose the omega over T scale?
Yeah. I mean, you think about it, you kind of said it. You don't talk.
Yeah, but maybe, you know, somehow, this theory, this comes from some boson exchange, right? At finite temperature, presumably that boson also acquires a thermal mass. So, and, you know, that thermal mass should also have kind of corrects, you know, if it's strongly coupled, should have T scale. And then maybe once the thermal mass is included, you do recover.
Yeah, so one place that I've got lots, and you find that you can sort of get collapses in certain frequency regions, right? So you can collapse sort of frequency of order temperature, but then the scaling at large frequency completely fouls up and the other way around and so forth. It's just not scaling, and I think it makes perfect sense, because at the end of the day, you know that you're doing perturbation theory around a Fermi liquid, and a Fermi liquid is a stable state that knows about scale Fermi energy, and it's remarkable that in a bare sensibility, in a bare pair sensibility, it drops out. It's interesting that when you push the limit, right, and you go to the deep infrared regime, where it can get again conformal behavior, that it can again forget about it. But generically, it knows about its scale EF. You need special circumstances to avoid that knowledge. Right? There's no protection against that scale in general. So you expect it in sort of messy intermediate regimes to always pop up.
Just before we thank Ian, I'm just reminded there's a dinner tonight and you can sign up on the wiki. Thanks, Ian.